Okay, everyone. Well, I'm sure you're burning to answer questions on that one. Who's going to start the ball rally? Who's going to take the first shot at this? Lovely.
Yeah,
I
was.
When you quoted Samuelson at the beginning, good old Samuelson,
the great textbook writer. Your definition, I found interesting. Allocation of scarce resources with or without money. I found that an interesting. I didn't realise he actually said that. With or without money. What was he doing? Did someone not proof his work or something?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure which edition of his textbook, whether that's in the new edition or not. But
seems a bit of a concession on his part.
Yeah.
Bear in mind, he was obviously marginalist theorist.
Unless he's trying to track his theory further back into history, perhaps, as well, as I've said, with all
possibly,
that money.
That's worth looking into.
Anyone else? Any comments?
I thought that was a really good talk, and I'd like a photocopy of the talk if possible.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I want to be honest. Most of the things that you quoted, Mark, from the beginning, really, they were something that I read in the past, but I wondered how, in a sense, being in here, you know, the idea of wanting to change society, say, look, this is a madhouse we're living under. In a sense, I would say, I might take up what William Morris said about having himself read Capital. But I haven't read Capital. I might have only, like yourself, all those pages to read, you know, try to shortcut it and look at things and speak to people to understand it. But to get workers, for workers who want to understand it, because if capitalism is reproducing itself, means that the workers themselves are supporting to various degrees. But in periods like now, this crisis, if you look at the insides of that Morning Star, which I loaned to you because there's an article on the crisis and what's happening in Europe, we need to look at what workers' responses are, because you're having demonstrations in India about the rising costs, the way that costs are rising here, but the essentials in parts of the world has been repeated now as it was in 2007. And the food riots that took place then, in regards to the recent riots that we just had, I looked at a small book on riots. And once the marketisation of foodstuffs in Britain in the 17th, 18th century, it's then when riots started to develop, where workers actually, you know, had processions, you know, with their trumpets and drums and people going down to these grain stores. Now, not to replicate that, to say, look, you know, violence is not the way out, rioting is something that's spontaneous. To understand, to get a grasp of it, of the system, do you think the way that we've got to present it in a way that people can read it in a sense of a popular format? You know, because Marx is heavy going, I won't deny it. I mean, I'm not even going very much through it, but I mean, to popularise it, to understand crises, why they're happening. I'd like to understand the crisis from the point of view of the financial side that's developed over the last 30 years. Why is it that financial capital is top-heavy, where in the past financial capital was small? We had a vast expansion, and this interdependent system is affecting everything across the world now in various degrees. America, Europe, China, Southeast Asia. Now, this is what I'm trying to say in a very long way is, how do we get workers from not supported? The ones around here are not, we don't know if they're supported or not, but we know that the demonstrations in Greece, Ireland, Spain, India, America. So workers are being stirred up by this very crisis, but thinking that money is the cause, thinking that if only the governments continue with the debt austerity measures, it's going to rectify. According to Galloway, we're having in place now things that happened with structural adjustment in the African states when they said to them, right, you've got to get rid of your infrastructure, welfare, hospitals, education, all the things that support the functioning of a society. So, you know, that's... Yeah. Angus, I don't know what.
I agree with Dylan. I had to get a question out of that. But yeah.
Well, that's yeah. It's how do we get our ideas across in a way that
can the only be, way you can get ideas across is by discussing with people and using every means at our disposal, isn't it?
Yeah. But I'll ask you the question. Why is it that the trade unions are putting forward saying that the austerity measures is a political action, it's an ideological response? In other words, there's an option to do something else. What is the option in their terms? That is it a Keynesian option, if it is?
Well, unions, they're on a reformist agenda, aren't they? So they're probably following some sort of Keynesian scheme.
Yeah, I think implicit in the question is that we should be beating ourselves up because we haven't got we don't seem to have a way of putting our arguments that can convince the rest of the working class. Well, I don't subscribe to that at all. I think we put forward our ideas in a way that in every way possible, and in a way that's easily understood. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to understand it, and I wouldn't be here today. So it's not completely up to our party to bring about a revolution. It's up to the working class, and they'll do it in their own good time.
I think day schools like this are very useful, and the talk that Darren's given is very useful to us as party members. Sympathisers and people who are fairly familiar with the Socialist Party. That I'm pretty certain of. But what I, not just myself, but I'm sure probably most people here are well aware of, that the vast majority of the population walking outside there on Clapham High Street and other parts of the country and the world are not going to be brought to socialism by deep and detailed theory. Of course, we've got to have a detailed understanding of the world. Marx and other people have made very, very valuable contributions about that. But of course, our basic task is communicating the most important elements of those theories to people at large. And the fact that there are, I think, two or three important factors to be borne in mind here about how the public view politics and perhaps economics, although they might not use that word. On the positive side, whereas 50 or 60 years ago, political leaders were largely viewed with reverence by the majority of the population, not just in this country, but probably in most parts of the world. Most of that reverence has disappeared, probably particularly in the last 10 to 15 years. And that is quite good from our point of view, because obviously we're against leadership in any significant form, and we're very much in favour of a true democracy and people acting collectively for their own interests, not putting their trust in any type of leadership form of organisation. So that mistrust and scepticism that huge numbers of people have now, I think, is something very positive and good from the point of view of the Socialist Party. On the other side of the coin, of course, politics has become, I think, well, it's not just what I think, but I think most people would recognise that that politics is not of great interest to the vast majority of people Probably because they've seen how politicians have broken promises and other factors like that. The problem is that most people, although they obviously recognise that politicians have broken promises, they don't really understand why they've broken those promises and why the economic system has made them do that. But I think to put it in practical terms and to try to put it in a nutshell, I think all the time when we're communicating with people outside who are not familiar with the Socialist Party and our attitudes, we have to, obviously we've got our theories, vitally important though they are, we have to put them forward in simplistic terms, but not just that, but in terms of which people can relate to their everyday experiences. Why they're losing their jobs, why prices are going up in the shops, why certain wars are breaking out in different parts of the world. And that, I know that there are other groups who've talked about this word link, but it is important to us as well that we have to try and forge a link in people's minds between the theory of opposing capitalism and looking for an alternative form of socialism, and how we can get that link across by relating what our theory to people's everyday and long-term experiences.
You want to comment on that?
I don't think
so. Brian?
Yeah, it's simple actually. Can you say something about the concept of scarcity? Because this is a key idea for free market, you know, for classical economists, as it were. I mean, what would be Marx's approach to the whole idea of scarcity?
Well, Marx didn't discount the idea of supply and demand being a factor in determining prices. But the thing with supply and demand... Okay, so if demand's high and supply's low, they say that leads to a rise in price. Or the other way around, it leads to a fall in price. But if supply and demand are equal, you kind of... that doesn't affect the price, so... You kind of need some other theory apart from supply and demand to be able to explain why things have a price in the first place.
Really, it's always puzzled me. I can understand... years ago I joked about, with Margaret Thatcher, that there were privatised water, thinking that was a joke, And then they did it. And now I joke about privatising fresh air for good ecological reasons. The air's polluted, therefore we need to privatise it. And this kind of explains what is scarcity. Because, fresh air is not scarce at all. Yeah. We can all breathe it in. But if you privatise it, it then becomes scarce, So I that's how I kind of try and understand what is meant by scarcity. But of course, it was an idea that came after Marx. It was only developed
around the same time, but
Malthus.
Yeah.
It's that tradition, isn't it?
Yeah.
Started with Malthus. Yeah. Forgot old Malthus.
Anyone else spoken yet? One time.
Darren, I've read when I flick through like my comrade here. Having flicked through Capital without reading it at all, I did notice something about vulgar economists, and I think in the Communist Manifesto, which I do read. Now, what did Marx mean about that, or does that have a significance amongst all the rest? Because when I'm watching television and they're dragging out the Fukuyamas and all the rest of it, telling us about end of history and all this stuff, I see them as vulgar economists. They're making big money. But I think my view is probably not what Marx expected it to be.
Well, Marx was quite keen on being disparaging of other views.
So am I.
So vulgar economists is kind of Well, it would be what we describe as the mainstream economists of today, really.
So I am right then.
Yeah.
No, Rob, you haven't spoken yet.
Well, one of the main problems I've found in doing trade union work for Usdaw, the shop workers union, is a lot of people turn around to me and say, we don't actually sort of, I guess they say, you know, we don't directly produce things anymore. You know, we're service sector workers. I wonder if you've got anything to sort of say on that, because obviously this is a wider kind of contention of bourgeois sort of economic theory, as far as I can work out. I'm not a trained economist, but what they're saying is a lot of people now, you know, aren't direct producers. Therefore, you know, they're not members of the working class. Therefore, Marxism, socialism, whatever, doesn't really apply to them anymore. I don't know how you'd approach that.
With the service sector, I mean, the thing is, things like transportations of goods and selling them in shops and stuff, that's really part of the productive process anyway. So, but then I guess if you get to, well, there's a definition of productive and unproductive labour, whether they're increasing the amount of value or whether it's just siphoning it from where it's already been produced. But it kind of be a mistake to think that that it's only kind of factory work that creates new value. It's not. It is transportation and other things. Then working class, it's a relation to the means of production, isn't it? It doesn't mean what your job is. So the fact that you're having to, you know, you're not earning, I don't know, if you work in some insurance company, you're not earning your living from your ownership of money, you're still having to sell your labour power to. So that's where they're going wrong there. So if you take class to mean how you earn a living, I mean, you'd have an infinite amount of classes. You could say chip shop owners form their own class or something. So it's just taking the meaning of class to be a relation to means of production, I think. Yeah.
And by saying it's a distribution
form, is part of
production
without distribution. Yeah. Distribution is part of production,
Did you want to say
that? Oh, yeah. Oh, thanks. Like Robbie, I'm a veteran of many years, a trade union veteran. I can honestly claim that now. I feel quite proud. And the issues that Rob raises, I've had to deal with as well. And one of the things I've found, is I found using Ed Balls quite useful, actually, because when you're Ed Balls wrote, Ed Balls, for all his faults, is actually quite a competent economist, albeit slightly vulgar. Like, he's a good, he knows his stuff. He's not an idiot. I thought he was, actually, but he's not. I've read some of his stuff. He did a very famous speech I can't remember, but it's the Bloomberg speech, and it was basically his critique of the idea of too much austerity at one time, tipping the economy to a double dip recession. And it was such a competently worked speech. Even Boris Johnson, when he was arguing with David Cameron about allocation of funds to London, sort of picked up on it and said, I think old Balls is onto something, which is a major concession. I used that as an argument for the people in my shop, because I'm the shop steward there. And rather than giving them sort of Marxist stuff, which straight off the hook, you know, SPGB type stuff or whatever you want to call it, I decided that could come, you need a way in. And a way in would be to say, if people got this idea in their heads that this is inevitable, there has to be cuts because of budget, whatever, usual stuff, you say, well, actually, it's funny you should say that, because not all the people in the ruling parties, the ruling class, are actually saying that. There's actually an argument. That means there's a space. Okay, and that and also links into the ideological argument about how much of it is ideological and how much of it is necessary. I mean, traditionally, I would have argued it was absolutely necessary to restore the law of value, etc., that kind of thing. But I think capitalism has got so much more going on in it, just other than just having a very sort of straight, traditional economic analysis of it. You could say that there is scope, there is different ways they could actually deal with the budget and impose austerity. They could do it in a slightly different way. So there is an argument there. That would indicate there's an ideological element to it from the actual Conservative Party, and the Labour Party would do it in a slightly different way. So how that helps us in terms of the grand project of achieving socialism, I don't know. But in terms of a rhetorical device, when talking to people face to face, it just moves them away from this idea of inevitability and opens up the space. If you can say, look, even the ruling class don't actually agree that this is absolutely necessary, at least on a rhetorical level they don't, that opens up the space for other arguments, such as the Socialist Party. So, I think I'll stop there.
Sorry, Darren, I called your mark earlier on when I spoke to you.
I thought you said Mark.
If you could say something about these hedge funds, equity groups, right, in a simple... I know that... they're very pathological. They seem to want, to impose these austerities to the point, they're squeezing the life out of societies. And how it's possible, because it's brutish. What they're doing is brutish, and the people at the sharp end of it realise these are thugs in an office. So if you could say something about the hedge funds and the role that they're playing in actually, in relationship to the debt in various countries or...
I think it might be outside the scope of say anything meaningful on that, really. Right. But, to do with the cuts, probably useful to think of that more in terms of restoring profit rates than any of the other reasons you sort of hear in the media.
Anyone else?
One of you tell us something about how Marxist labour theory of values economics were sort of inspired, well, not just inspired, but actually developed from the classical school. We saw some people like Ricardo and...
He obviously, no one kind of conjures up ideas out of magic in their own, suddenly wakes up one day, do they? Marx's value theory is kind of built on the Ricardian ideas, but it's not this, a critique of it really. He sort of sees the mistakes of Ricardo to... the stumbling block of Ricardo was Ricardo didn't see the difference between prices. I might be getting this wrong, but between prices and values, thinking that things always sell at their value rate rather than, which I didn't cover in this talk, in the Marxian system, things don't actually sell at the values. It's just through the struggle for competition, sort of values is distributed amongst capitalists. It's also in Marx that he differentiated between labour and labour power, which if you don't do that, you kind of end up in a bit of a contradiction when you're trying to say, well, how much, what is the value of labour? So 1 hour's labour is worth 1 hour's labour. You kind of get in a circular kind of argument, but he kind of realised that what was being sold wasn't the actual labour as such, it's kind of just the capacity of the worker to reproduce themselves. But there is this, vulgar economics, there's actually most people that do call themselves Marxist economics these days, Safarian, might be right, which is kind of based on a Ricardian reinterpretation of Marx, which seems a bit strange, being that he spent a lot of his time criticising Ricardo, but I could go on, but that's from.
We're talking about how we as workers regard capitalism and capitalists, how we see capitalism, the way it works, which is absolutely essential. I think it might be worthwhile actually sort of explaining to our fellow workers how capitalism sees us. Well, capitalism is a system where we are employed, not as beings, but as a means to an end. We're not an end in ourselves; we're a means, and that end is profit. So, if we look at the word employ, it also means to use and to exploit. And so, therefore, capitalism doesn't see us as beings, as humans. It sees us as things. It cannot identify with us, because you cannot
abuse, exploit, coerce, oppress those that you identify with. So therefore capitalism and capitalists are cynical in the sense that, you know, we have no real human being. We are just there to be exploited. And I think that's easily explained to our fellow workers, because, you know, the proof, the facts are all around to prove it irrefutably.
Leading on from Ben's point, on one level it is very easy to point this out to people, and I think at certain times people will nod their heads, particularly now maybe, because people are feeling the pinch, and say, yeah, that's true. But it doesn't seem to, that in itself, that understanding that intellectually doesn't seem to necessarily transcend anything. Because this comes back down to theories of human nature, people have got this, particularly when they're being oppressed, or so we're always being oppressed, but particularly when the thumb screws have been put on, workers, I think, this is the point that Zizek makes, you know, before people start to become revolutionary, you first of all, you go through a sort of almost like a reactionary psychological process whereby you sort of attune yourself to the new reality and you start to say, well, the problem is human beings. This is it. I mean, yeah, sure, I agree with you, Danny. Absolutely right. We're exploited, but that's the nature of the beast. That's the nature of humanity. I mean, so we have to get past that hurdle, that sort of almost emotional hurdle. And it is an emotional rather than an intellectual one, or maybe it's a bit of both. Of course, you can explain a concept, and people might agree with you. I remember having a conversation with someone at work once. I stand at the photocopier, and they said, "Oh, I wish we could work a 4-day week." And of course, being naive as I was at the time, I thought, "Oh my God, I'll get her in a party." When I was in a party at the time, I'll get her in a party before lunchtime. And of course, when I explained to her why she couldn't have a 4-day week, she couldn't get away quick enough. and that's the problem, because sometimes people don't actually want answers to the questions they raise. Because the human mind isn't just rational. There's other elements going on there, the irrationality, with the whole history of psychoanalysis for the last 100 years. And that's the problem, I think. You know, just a purely rational approach doesn't necessarily get anywhere, because you have to understand, I think we must know this by now, surely, human beings are not entirely rational. We're rational in one respect, but deeply irrational in others. So we have to find some kind of mechanism which marries those two together.
Rocky, do you want to say
something? I think a vital contribution the SPGB makes and has made throughout its existence towards economic theory is we don't really believe that capitalism will automatically collapse in and of itself. Obviously not just because of what's going on in the moment, but this is a kind of wider, this is a debate within the wider kind of current of the left. For example, the Socialist Workers Party more or less goes along with the American economist and historian Robert Brenner, who essentially argues, you know, that more or less these are the end times. This is, you know, that this could well be the final crisis of capitalism. Now, of course, you know, various people from Lenin and even before onwards have been arguing that this is the final crisis and capitalism's about to collapse. Now, the SPGB has never said that. And on the other side of this debate, there's also kind of more interesting, to my mind, left-wing economists and writers such as Bill Jefferies, who are saying, well, no, you know, capitalism isn't about to collapse. Actually, if anything, it's probably, just in terms of profitability and the rest of it, it's kind of stronger than it's ever been. So you know, you have this sort of two poles within the left. Like I say, we in the SPGB have always maintained that capitalism will never collapse, you know, because of its own, on its own. I wonder if, you know, you've got anything to sort of say about that and how we could kind of communicate that.
Crises are just part of the normal functioning of the capitalist system, so.
So for example, you know, the last book that Chris Harman did, and who was the editor of Socialist Worker and was a great sort of, you know, commentator on these things. I think he's passed away. I'm not sure. Yeah. I think he's died,
isn't
he? I saw
him 2 weeks before he died.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Was he looking peaky?
Must be something
must have. What did he do? But his last book was called Zombie Capitalism. Yeah. You know, so it was this idea that capitalism's outlived its usefulness. You know, that it's basically just kind of sort of carrying on, but it's not actually kind of developing the modes of production any further if you want to use it in a sort of old-fashioned kind of language. I don't know how you kind of respond to that.
Deccan's theory.
Yeah, that's what they call it, isn't it? But, well, I mean, I'm not sure really how to comment on back on that.
Do crises get ever worse? Or why is there this idea that crises always, there must be this last move process of crisis growth? I mean, surely, I mean, a Marxian approach must surely at least have the possibility of it not being a linear, smooth process. It has to go through, certain qualitative ups and certain qualitative downs. And I think that's one thing I've always found missing from the SBGB a little bit. This idea you have this sort of very smooth crisis theory where it always works itself back up, because until you get political consciousness, you can't have a revolution. But to me, those are two separate questions. They're not two separate questions, but they relate to each other. But not in a, you can't have your economics based upon your political theory, is what I'm saying. Just because one believes that you get revolution in a particular way, that can't determine how you view crisis.
That makes any sense. Yeah, I mean,
which would be possibly a criticism.
Well, a theory is not true or false because of its implications,
no,
is it?
So,
but I don't think there's anything to just suggest that, I don't know, productivity sort of, crisis goes up and down, and it's a